Well, good evening. I don't have that much to say tonight, so I thought that it would be a good chance to hear some questions from you, because I've been getting lots of great questions and comments and ideas just as we, pass each other at meals and walking along the trails here. And I just think I've presented enough at this point that we ought to have a chance to engage in some conversation back and forth about what you've heard, what's been helpful, what's been confusing, what's been surprising. And we've even turned the lights on so that you know you're actually important. So here's what I'd like to do for the first 10 minutes or so. I'd like to get 5 questions, sort of an arbitrary number, and I'd like to get a question from roughly every decade of age represented here. So I think we're going to start with a question from someone, you have to figure out who this is, under the age of 20. Then we'll have a question from someone under the age of 30, then someone under the age of 40, 50, and after that it gets awkward. So we'll just say anyone over that age, we'll pick from that age group. Does that make sense? So we'll sort of hear different questions probably from different ages and stages of life. And you can ask me anything you want, or you can just comment on something that you've been thinking about as a result of what I've been presenting. And I think that'll be helpful to all of us. So, can we start with someone anywhere in this hall under the age of 20 who has a question or comment that's been sort of provoked by what I've said so far? So you have to be bold. An example question? How can I be as good looking as you and cool? I don't know. You have a question? Go for it.
Why do you care about culture?
That's a great question. Well, do you mean really why do I think everyone should care, or why? How have I personally come to care about
it? I guess both.
Okay. Great question. Let me start with personally. The reason I've come to care about this enough to spend my time sort of developing talks on it and writing a book on it and so forth is that I became aware of how much culture had shaped me and was shaping the way that I lived my faith. I actually got into this topic because I was thinking and writing and speaking about consumer culture. So I was becoming aware that if there's one adjective to describe the culture we're all living in North America, it's a consumer culture. And I actually think that's a particularly toxic environment to try to be a follower of Jesus. So I had all these great critiques of consumer culture and why we shouldn't be part of it. And I got more and more dissatisfied with that, because I felt like all I was doing, it was like I talked about this morning, you know, when all you do is criticize, I just felt like I was constantly critiquing consumption and consumerism and malls and so forth. And I realized if we don't have an alternative to this, we're not going to be able to resist it. So that's really how I got into this broader question of thinking about culture. Now, why I think everyone else should care, well, I've come to think the best answer to that is simply that God cares about culture. This is actually something that was part of God's plan from the beginning. So if we care about God's intention for human beings, we're going to care about this. But we also care about it because it's actually what we get to do as human beings. It's like our job as human beings is to be culture creators and culture cultivators. And that's our calling. So it's sort of the basic human thing that we're supposed to do. Okay, someone under between 20 and 30. All the way at the back. Now that's not fair. This is not Duck Duck Goose.
One thought I had, since nobody raised their hand, and I've just barely made it under the wire, I'm 29.
that works.
Is when you're talking about, we're discussing heaven and how heaven is a city, or at least that Revelation picture of it, it kind of made me a little bit sad, because what becomes of nature if if heaven is a city.
Oh, you know? Wonderful question.
And then, so the sub part of that is, you know, I know that the image of the lambs lying with the lions and that sort of thing, but you know, there's a big part of creation that's very ruthless and sort of brutal, you know, if you look at the way animals treat each other and stuff.
Yes,
so,
right.
So anyway, that's sort of the thought that popped in my head.
Yeah. Well, that's a wonderful question, and I guess it's a question in two parts. Yes, well, this is something I didn't get to, but actually in Revelation 21, the interesting thing about this city is it's a city with a garden in it. So the tree of life, there's this river that runs through the city, and the tree of life, strangely enough, John says, is on both sides of the river. So I guess there's more than one member of the species. And this city actually is a city with a garden. Now, obviously, John is trying to describe something that is indescribable and inexplicable to us. But I think that what he's getting at by describing the new creation as a city with a garden is that it's actually a place where nature and culture meet. So that all of the potential of creation that's in the natural world will be there as well, I think. Because God said it was good, and I don't know why God, having done something good, would then undo it or forget it. Now, the question of what exactly will happen to all the ways that nature seems to us to be fallen and broken in itself is imponderable, I think. But writers like Isaiah give us little hints that there's going to be some way to be creaturely and natural in the new creation in which death will not be the sort of operating principle. And I have no idea exactly what that will look like, but I trust it because someone has come back to the dead and verified it for us, and that's all I know to go on. But that's wonderful, helps fill out this picture of what this new creation is. It's not just urban. It's Central Park at its best, you know, but more than Central Park. Okay, someone between 30 and 40. Probably they're going to be way over there, and I'll have to run again. Okay, right in the middle here. You were raising your hand, right? Or you changed your mind?
Unfortunately, I'm over 40.
Oh, you're 40. Oh, hold on. You can be our over 40 person. That's what happens when you turn 40. You start thinking, no, I'm like 33. What's the big deal here? Okay.
I guess... my question is, are humans really moving culture, or does culture move humans?
Next question.
Sorry.
Wonderful question. I was talking with this with some folks about this last night. Well, of course the answer is both. Culture, we come into culture, and it is the world in which we live, and we cannot live without it. Any baby who's born without the benefit of culture dies. There is no way to be human without being shaped by culture. In fact, there are these very sad cases of children who manage to grow up but largely without language, for example. Either they're terribly abused, or there are these cases of children who are kind of quasi-raised by animals or wolves or whatever. And what you find is these folks really do not realize fully what it is to be human. They lack a lot of capacities that we associate with being everything God meant us to be, which doesn't mean they're not valuable, but they haven't expressed what being human is. So culture shapes us profoundly. It moves us. At the same time, people made it, and people keep making it. And it's this sort of dialectic or conversation that keeps happening. And the sociologists can get very up in the lather about how we're all culturally determined, but then they don't live that way consistently because they all keep writing academic papers that purport to show something new for the discipline, you know, to get tenure. And they themselves don't act like it's all been done and we're just sort of being moved by culture. They realize that though we have been shaped by it, we then turn around and by adding to it, we shape what the next generation inherits and thinks of as culture. So I don't know, you know, I think it is both. All right, now we'll come back to our 52-year-old here.
I was just wondering if there's some knowledge about the, you know, the sort of size of the city, you know. It seems like that has to be a pretty big place.
It sure does, doesn't it? Augustine, when faced with questions like said that, well, it was Augustine was answering the question, what was God doing before he created the world? He said God was preparing a hell for people who ask questions like that. And again, I think, you know, we do wonder, right? I mean, John gives some dimensions. They're very schematic dimensions, 144,000 cubits and so forth. He says the angel had a measuring rod, and the angel was, he says specifically, was using human measurement, which is nice to know, you know, as opposed to the angel using some angelic measurement. But surely, it's, I have no idea. I mean, you know, we are going to, the recreated state is, all we know about it is Jesus, really. All we know about are these fragmentary stories of the resurrection body of Jesus that, for one thing, seems to be able to, Jesus' body is now not restricted to place. I mean, Jesus still has a body. His body was not taken away. Last Thursday in the Episcopal calendar, we celebrate the ascension of Jesus. Well, his body isn't, like, removed at that point. But where is that body? Where is that resurrection body now that his followers could actually touch, could handle, that could eat fish, but also could walk through walls, could disappear? Well, I can't answer that question. What will our bodies be like? What will that new world be like? All we know is that John says, I can give you this sort of this set of images, but what it will be like is truly beyond our comprehension, and it would probably terrify us if we knew what it really was going to be like, because we're not ready for it. And it would be too wonderful for us. We'd run away from it. And so that's the best we can probably do. So one more question from someone who is over 50. Yes.
That answers your question that the culture is not important. When you say we don't, you just answered just my feeling about it all.
Try to hold the mic just so everyone can hear. Thank you.
I mean, it's a long time off. What's the culture going to be like in those days? But the point is that God has infinite. He's created everything. He has infinite power. We have no concept. And he created time. He created time just for us. In his, there was no time. He created time when he created this world for Christ. This world is created for Christ.
Right.
And he had to create time because he created us, and there had to be this plan. I don't understand the plan.
Yeah.
But I don't say that anything is happening here or this world or any culture or anything we do is relevant to what is yet to come, even though Revelations does point. And I just got through with Revelations.
Huh.
And my suggestion on that is do an overview on it and think a lot.
Yeah.
But I'm for God. But, you know, I don't know.
All that I know that we can know is the little hints that John gives us. And especially the things he says more than once. And so all I know is that somehow the best of human culture is going to be part of God's ultimate realization of his plan. And yes, beyond that, there are a lot of questions, aren't there? And we trust on these things. I'm available for lots more questions and conversation as we go. So let's keep it up. But I wanted to follow up on a few topics from earlier today. Again, just to remind you, I did upload the slides so far. I'll keep uploading them. I hope none of you have been using the internet like I was earlier today. I hope you've been doing more productive things. But culturemakers.com/FPCB, and you'll be able to remember, if there was anything helpful, you'll be able to remember it. I find it helpful when we're thinking about these different postures we can take toward culture and that Christians have taken toward culture, to distinguish between postures and gestures. And I want to say in a little bit, I'm going to actually have something on the screen that it will help to be able to see it very clearly. So if there's anyone still in the back who can turn off these center lights so that we have better visuals on the slides, that would be great. There are postures and there are gestures. Your posture is the way you carry yourself through life, your basic attitude toward the world. But of course, we don't. We have one basic posture, but we don't just have one set of gestures. We make lots of different kinds of gestures in the course of a good day. So I've been here with you all, and some of you I know well, and you're kind of huggy people, and so when I meet you, I hug you. But others of you, that would be kind of awkward, and so I shake your hand. And then others, we have this kind of manly thing that men do where you shake the hand and you, like, grip the other guy's elbow or you, like, pat them on the shoulder, right? And there are all these different ways that we can greet each other, and they're all appropriate for different people. They're all the right gesture for different people. So I've been thinking about these postures, and it occurs to me that really all of these postures are good gestures for particular cultural goods. So there are some cultural goods or cultural phenomena that when they happen around us, the proper gesture towards them is condemnation. The right thing to do with certain things in culture that human beings make of the world is to say, this really needs to stop. And to muster all the legitimate force we can to stop it. There are some things in culture that the proper gesture, just to raise your hand and try to get the slide to go, is critique. So art is really designed for critique. When Picasso paints this painting, Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, he is not looking for you to condemn his painting. He's not really interested in whether you like it or not. He doesn't want you to copy it, you know, to sort of, maybe we could make this into a Christian Demoiselle d'Avignon. First we'd cover some things, and then we could, have them singing worship songs or something, right? He doesn't want you to just consume it. He doesn't just want you to make, like, wallpaper for your bedroom and just sort of, you know, plaster his art all over and just sort of take it in and not think about it. What Picasso wants you to do when he paints, and what any serious artist wants you to do, is to, he or she is painting to start a conversation. And what kind of conversation? A critical conversation. Not in the sense of criticizing, but in the sense of asking, what does this mean? Why does the artist do what he does? Why do we have an African mask in here? Why are the noses in the wrong place sometimes, you know? Well, why is Picasso doing that? It's meant to start a conversation about the world that we live in and what we make of it. So the right gesture for art, the right thing to do with art, is to critique it. That's what it's designed for. Now, I actually also think that copying can be a totally fine cultural gesture. I kind of made fun of the Jesus Died for Pedro t-shirt, but this is a picture of Martin Luther. And I put it up just because it said, I think this may not actually be true, but it's a nice story anyway, that Martin Luther would take these songs that were sung at the bar, you know, Heide, Hand, und Hüschen, Wagen, or whatever, and he would put Christian music, Christian lyrics to those same tunes. And so Sunday morning, they would be singing tunes that were familiar, but it had lyrics about Jesus in the worship. Now, it's said that the Wesleys did the same thing, John and Charles. But I choose Luther because I can sort of imagine Luther singing the song at the bar on Saturday nights and then going down and singing it in church on Sunday morning. And I think that's a nice model for culture. So there's nothing wrong with taking cultural forms and putting them to work in our worship, right? We have to do this. When we're going to sing praise to God, we're going to have to sing in a language that we share. We're not going to make up a special praise language to only use in church. We're going to sing in English or in this congregation, but other congregations will sing in, you know, Zulu or Korean or whatever. And that's a good thing. And it's good to take music and all the forms of music and put them to work in worship. It's a great gesture. It's not such a good posture. Right? It's a great gesture. It's a great thing to do for certain occasions, but not to become the dominant way that we relate to culture. And I think that consumption is a fine gesture too. The bread will not be good tomorrow, not as good. Enjoy it today. The point is not to condemn the bread or evaluate the bread. Is this Christian bread? We do not ask what is the worldview of this bread. You know, have worldview seminars on baguettes and, you know, focaccia and so forth. The point is not to copy the form of bread and say, well, you really can only eat bread if it has little fish symbols carved into the top, because then we know it's Jesus' bread and it's good for you. No, it's just good. Bread is just good. It's meant to be consumed. And there's nothing wrong with the gesture of consumption toward things that are good to be consumed and that are good for you and can that help you enjoy and celebrate God's creation. So all of these are fine gestures toward particular cultural things. And we could probably add some more. I was talking with one of you this afternoon who was asking about kind of what about withdrawing from certain parts of culture, just not engaging with them. And I said, well, that's fine, but that does not begin with the letter C, so it doesn't fit in my talk. I actually should mention, this is a gift that Southern Baptists bring to the body of Christ. I used to present this material, and things didn't begin with the letter C, and then some Southern Baptist friends got a hold of it, and when it came back to me, it all started with the same letter. So alliteration is the spiritual gift of the Southern Baptists. But in spite of not beginning with the letter C, this is an appropriate gesture to limit our exposure to certain kinds of culture, not necessarily even because they are all bad, but because for us the horizons of possibility and impossibility they create just don't work well for us, are not life-giving for us. For our family, this means that we don't watch broadcast television. With the exception of the Philadelphia Phillies, who we are fanatical about. Amen. It's a completely lost cause. So we've chosen in our house, and for the foreseeable future, that is until next spring, for a long time, that we will not, we just won't watch broadcast TV or cable TV. We watch movies. We have a little DVD player hooked up to our monitor, and that's fine. We aren't legalistic about it, but it just feels like for us as a family, there are other things we want to do with our life besides watch advertising-supported television. And that's a fine gesture. The problem is that if it becomes a posture, then you kind of get bent. And think about what happens when your posture, at least according to your mother, what happens when you have a bad posture, okay? When I was 13, I was sort of growing fast, and I was trying to hunch over to sort of fit in with the other 13-year-olds. My mother would say, well, you're going to, if you keep doing that, you'll have a bad posture. Well, what she meant was you'll lose freedom of movement. You'll become sort of permanently bent in a particular direction. And whether my mother was right about that or not, that is what happens when these gestures become postures. We lose the capacity to do other things. But if your posture is right, then you're free to do all these gestures. And isn't this the way it works in culture? People who are known as cultivators and creators of excellent culture, when they speak up and condemn something, do people listen? Yes. When they critique something, when they have something to say about what's behind, what's the worldview behind, or what are the ideas behind a particular cultural work, that critique carries weight. And they're able to copy without just being imitators. They're able to just sort of take something that someone else has done and do something really cool with it. And when our posture is cultivating and creating, we can consume without becoming consumers. People are defined by consumption. So if your posture is right, you can do all the gestures. But if one of the gestures becomes your posture, you lose the ability to do all the other things, especially to be cultivators and creators. So let's think a little more. I want to just go back to these postures of cultivating and creating. And this is where you get to talk to one another in a moment. Let's start with cultivating. Last time I put up a vineyard, and I know that's very California and so forth, but I thought it was worth putting up a picture of plumbing, because I actually am grateful for plumbing. And I don't really want a creative plumber, per se. I had some work done on our heating system last fall, and the plumber came in, and we explained what we needed to be done. And what I really did not want the plumber to say at that point was, I have this whole new vision for plumbing. Like, the way it's always been done is just not right. I'm going to try something completely new with your heating system. It's going to be so awesome. I'm a postmodern plumber, right? I was so glad that this guy who came to take care of my plumbing just wanted to take good care of this good human thing called plumbing and keep it working. So there's a lot of culture where the right posture towards it is really just cultivating. And we spend a lot of our lives just taking good care of what previous generations have passed on to us that is actually very good. And that is a little bit like the leather skins that God creates for people. It's just, it's a gift. It's mercy that we have this. Systems of justice, the rule of law, the whole infrastructure that sustains equality under the law for many people in our society. It's not perfect, but it's awfully good, and it's a lot better than what many people in history have had to live with. And so it's good just to keep that going, to sustain it, to become expert in some part of it so that you're able to tend and nurture and affirm that part of it. Anyone who's ever learned a sport, right? You know, you don't go onto the baseball field, unless you're my 10-year-old, and say, I'm making up new rules to baseball, right? You know, I'm a creative baseball player. We're going to do it a different way. No, the thing you have to do when you're in Little League is you just learn how to do what people have already done because it's a great game. And you need to learn how to play it. And you have to just swing that bat over and over. And frankly, there's nothing that creative about perfecting your swing, right? But it's just cultivating. It's taking what's been passed on to you and learning it yourself so that someday you'll be able to pass it on to someone else and you'll be able to use it in good creative ways. And same thing with music. You know, a lot of what we do when we're training as musicians is we just play scales. And no one would pay to hear you play scales. And yet you have to do that. You have to cultivate it in order to become someone who can contribute creatively. So here's my first question about your calling, each of you, each of us. What are you cultivating? At this point in your life, what are some of the things in human culture that you feel called to affirm and tend and nurture and pass on at least in as good shape as they came to you? Because this is really where we start. And so what I'd like you to do is actually talk with some people that, ideally some people you're connected with in some way, even if it's just that you're sitting on the same bench with them. Find a smallish group and just share with each other a few answers to this question. And maybe if you know each other, you can say, you know, actually, James, what I see you're especially good at cultivating is this. Or here's something I've watched you cultivate and take good care of in our culture. And let's just make a kind of a short list for each of us of some of the things that we particularly are called to cultivate as culture cultivators. So you'll have about 6 or 7 minutes to do that. Find your little group and talk with each other and learn from each other. A few more minutes, so make sure everybody has a chance to say something. 1 more minute. All right, finish your thoughts. Okay. Stop your thoughts. Interrupt your thoughts. Now, there are not too many times that I wish I could hear every conversation at once, because of course that would drive one mad. But I always think in a group this big of all the different things that are being cultivated, that people are called to cultivate, and how many different answers there are in this room. Let's just hear, like, shout out just 1 or 2 words, something that someone in your group mentioned, just like 20 or so, just one after another. Nice and loud so we all can hear you.
Family.
Uh-huh, absolutely. Music.
Community.
Cultivating a sense of community, yes.
Love of nature.
Wait, compassion, I think someone said. Down here, someone said. Skinheads, this culture of hopefully positive skinheads. All right. Straight edge. Okay, what else?
Justice.
Justice, yeah. Flowers, amen. Culture itself, yeah. Altruism,
color,
the use of color, wonderful.
Arts,
friendships, literacy, There were a few more that I didn't hear. Anyway, we could go on a long time with this list because there's a lot to cultivate. And not all of us have to have the same answer, right? We're all made to cultivate something in particular. And a lot of finding our calling is figuring out what those few things are. For me, it's words. It's language used in ways that can reach people. I don't know how good a cultivator that I am, but it's something I'm called to cultivate. Tomorrow morning I'll share another thing that I cultivate with you. So that's question one. So question two is about creating. I wanted to share one of my favorite paintings with you. It's a painting by one of the greatest painters, Rembrandt, and it's called The Artist in His Studio. And it's become for me, I actually have a little postcard-sized print of this on my desk at home where I write and work, because it's become for me a real metaphor and image of what it means to be a creator of culture. And I want to even preface, before we look at this painting together, that of course not all of us are artists, not all of us have this sort of artistic temperament, and a lot of us, really the main thing we do is cultivate, and that is a very good thing to do. But creating is also part of the stamp of God's image on us. And so while we do this in very different ways, some of us do it in the lab, some of us do it in an office, some of us do it in a home, but all of us at one time or another have to take on this role, the role of the creator of culture. So we'll make it a little bigger. The first thing you need to know about this painting is it's actually very small. It's about the size of my laptop screen, about maybe 15 inches diagonal at most. It's in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and it's worth a trip if you ever are able to visit. So it's really a very small little painting of a small little artist. Doesn't he look kind of tiny? He's sort of standing back. What's the thing you mostly notice in this painting? The painting, the canvas, the imposing, sort of frightening easel. I find it quite intimidating to imagine being where that artist is. And then as you look at this painting a little longer, you start to notice where the light is in the artist's studio. Where is the light? It's on the painting, isn't it? It also sort of looks like it's coming from the painting. The light, of course, is coming in. He's arranged everything in his studio so the light will fall in the right way. So it'll fall on the canvas, and then it bounces off the canvas and reflects into the rest of the room. It's absolutely the center of everything he's done. He's actually put his canvas in a very awkward spot. It's sort of blocking the door. He can't get out till he makes some progress here. But presumably that's because that's where the best light is. And so if it's in front of the door, you just got to put the easel there because that's where you're going to be able to see what you're doing. So this artist is someone who's taken a lot of care to be in the right conditions to figure out what he should put on this canvas. Then there's the question of what is on the canvas. Don't you wonder? Isn't it not fair that he doesn't ever show us? Like, turn it around. Let's see. How's it going? A lot of people I talk to think the canvas is blank. It's interesting. People often just, their gut feeling is, this artist hasn't started yet. He's trying to figure out what to do on this blank canvas that he's just stretched and has just put up on his easel. And then other people think, and my 7-year-old was an example of this, she was quite convinced that he's been painting, and now he's stepped back, right, as you have to do when you're working. This is a fairly large canvas, since he's a very midget-like painter anyway. So he stepped back to sort of evaluate what he's done so far and ask what needs to be done next. And my precious daughter, Amy, without any coaching of any kind, she looked at this as I was preparing this presentation. I had it up on my screen, and I said, "Oh, Amy, you know, what do you think of this painting? What do you think the artist is doing?" And she said, "Oh, well, he's standing there like God did when he made the world, and he's saying, 'It is good.'" And isn't that beautiful? And I thought, wow, that is the voice of a child who hasn't learned to censor themselves, who hasn't learned that the first reaction to anything you do should be, "Oh, not good enough." someone who hasn't internalized that critical process where you make something and you're like, oh, that's a terrible drawing, crumple, crumple, throw it away. She has this sense that creativity is good, that what this artist has put on the painting is on the canvas is good. And she got it, that it's like what God does. I also love how Rembrandt paints the artist. I don't know if we want to say he paints himself. Rembrandt, of course, did paint himself often. He was a master of the self-portrait. And the self-portraits are worth traveling to see all over the world now. Rembrandt painted himself at every stage of life. And I don't know whether he intends this to be literally a picture of himself. He doesn't say, me in my studio. He says, the artist in his studio. But there's something very interesting about this artist besides his small stature compared to the looming painting. Well, it's a bunch of interesting things. He's kind of got one foot back, so you do have the sense that he's waiting. He's not in an aggressive posture toward the work. He's not sort of leaning in, hey, I'm ready to go, got something to say. He's waiting until the right moment comes to create something. He's also very balanced. His posture is actually quite good, isn't it? He's not... Off kilter. He's comfortable waiting in this position. And this is a big part of creativity. It doesn't come quickly, and the artist is willing to wait. But what I most like about the way the artist portrays himself is his face. And it's hard to fully appreciate this, you know, when it's 1280 by 924 pixels or whatever. But when you spend time with this painting, you want to get to know this artist because he seems like a pretty interesting guy. And it's a little frustrating because Rembrandt has painted this artist's face really as almost a little Mickey Mouse-like cartoon of a face. The eyes are little just black circles, just like a cartoonist would draw. And then there's a little nose, and that's about it. And what's interesting to me about that is that the greatest painter of faces in the history of Western art, arguably, is Rembrandt. Rembrandt knows how to paint a face. The best faces you'll ever see are Rembrandt faces. But he's chosen not to detail the face of the artist. Why would he do that? I guess I sense that he's saying, when the artist is in his studio, the work is what matters. It's whatever is going to be turned around on this canvas and eventually shown to us. We're going to forget the artist's face. But this work could last. It could last for centuries, as his work has, in fact, lasted. And Rembrandt was pretty serious about his faith, and so he might have had this inkling that his work could last through the fire and the purification and the transformation into the New Jerusalem. I love this picture. I think it's a picture of what it is to be a human being. This is what we get to do in all of our different spheres. So the calling question then, to talk with one another about a little bit, what are you creating? This is a harder question to answer, and the answers may not come quickly or easily. But why don't you turn to one another, just try to figure out what is it that you're trying to create? What new cultural good are you trying to be involved in bringing into the world? Spend a few minutes talking with each other about that question. One more minute. All right, finish that thought. All right, let's come back together. So I'm going to guess a couple things about the conversation you just had. One is that it was a more difficult question to ask than the cultivating, to answer than the cultivating question. I find this anyway. Second, I wonder if you found that this was a more vulnerable question to answer, that it felt a little hard to say out loud what you think you might be trying to create and to bring into being in this world. And then the third thing I wonder is whether you felt, when you did manage to speak out loud what you think you're creating, whether it just felt a little small. I'm trying to write a little book, you know. I'm trying to just create a family that works and that loves each other and no one gets killed in the process, you know. I'm trying to teach one classroom of second graders, right? I'm trying to put together a little band in my garage. Doesn't it feel like a little bit of a letdown? Yesterday we were talking about the iPod and Starbucks and the Toyota Prius, and then you get to, well, what are you creating? Yes, just nothing really. So I want to share the last little piece of content, really, that I have for the whole weekend, because tomorrow morning we're going to do something very different. But it's actually, to me, one of the most encouraging things I've discovered in thinking about how culture is made. And it's about the way that culture making happens. How do these cultural goods get created? And the amazing thing is that the process of creation of every cultural good starts very small. Specifically, it starts with an absolutely small group of people. Now, Rembrandt painted the artist alone in his studio. But that's actually not representative of even how art is done. For one thing, we are looking at the artist in his studio. The artist who painted the artist studio painted it for us. So there's already kind of a group thing happening there, right? And then whatever he does on his canvas is going to have to be sold. Probably someone will have to buy it. At least people will have to buy enough of his paintings that he gets to paint another. So there may be dealers involved. There will certainly be buyers involved. There will be people who appreciate what he's doing. There will be other artists who come in while he's working on what he's doing. So while Rembrandt captures that moment of one kind of creativity that's solitary, even Rembrandt, the artist, is part of a whole community that has to make any piece of culture. No cultural good is made by an individual because culture is public. It's shared by human beings. So it's always made by people. But every cultural good starts with a very small group of people. I call them the three. It's not always exactly three. Sometimes it's two. Sometimes it's four. Occasionally it's five. It's never one. And it's never very big. And every single cultural good ever created, I believe, started in the minds and hearts and creativity of a group of about three people. So we can think about, for example, the iPod. Now, the iPod has sold umpteen million units now. I can't remember. Did it hit 100 million or 50 million? It hit some big milestone recently. 200, yes, I figured. It's completely taken over the world, hasn't it? So it's sold millions and millions of units. But the iPod, in its creation, before it had sold a single unit, who was in the room when that was being dreamed up? Steve Jobs. Who was the other key person? Jonathan Ive. Maybe, I don't know, Phil Schiller, maybe one or two other people. But I can guarantee you, when that was first dreamed up, it was an absolutely small number of people who were in the room thinking about what they might make. And it's my conviction that this is true for every cultural good. It starts with an absolutely small group of people, the three. Now, it doesn't stay with them. They start to mobilize a still very small group, which I call the 12, around them to start making this cultural good happen. So Jonathan Ive and Steve Jobs and maybe Phil Schiller, one of the other senior executives at Apple, called some other people into the room, but no bigger than could fit in around a conference table, not nearly as big as this group, and said, hey, we've got this idea. We think this could work. What do you think? How can we make it better? Sometimes I think about a movie poster. Okay, you know, the movie posters you see, how many people are usually on the top line above the title of the movie? Or actually, think about down at the bottom, there's this whole list of names, and then it says a such and such film, and that gives the name of the film. Who comes before that title? How many people? Usually about three. And then how many people get on the movie poster? Well, I actually looked. To get there, I'm going to have to give away my next point. But anyway, there's a bigger group called the 120. I'll get to that. So I pulled up this Pirates of the Caribbean poster, since it's like Pirates of the Caribbean weekend. Not that I care in any way. So here at the top, we have Johnny Depp, Orlando Bloom, and Keira Knightley. Well, of course, they're the stars. But then if you read the small print, which you can't, but I blew it up. Actually, the one I blew up is from the latest one. It's not from Dead Man's Chest. Walt Disney Pictures presents Jerry Bruckheimer Films, a Gore Verbinski film, so two executive producers is probably what they're called, Johnny Depp, Orlando Bloom, Keira Knightley, Stellan Skarsgård, he doesn't count, he's Swedish, Bill Nye, with Chow Yun-fat and Jeffrey Bush. Okay, so there's a handful of people who were sitting around trying to make this film happen. They mobilized a slightly larger group. Total, I counted, trust me, of all the names on here, a couple names are on there twice, there's only about 30 people. Now, this is to make a motion picture that this weekend is probably being seen by, I don't know, 30 million human beings. But it's an absolutely small group of people. Now, there's slightly more than 12, I admit. And what happens is the 12 then mobilize a larger group, and I call this the 120. These numbers, don't get hung up on the exact number, but it's the rough proportions, 3, 12, 120. So the three in a major motion picture is the director, maybe one of the producers, maybe one, the executive producer. The 12 includes like the cinematographer, the major talent, the casting director, and not many more. The 120 is the people you see. They don't get on the poster, but they get in the credits. Now, there's usually more than 120 for a film because a film is one of the most complex cultural goods we create in our society. It's up there with, a jet airplane or something. So there's a lot of people who get into this wider circle. And they're the people who bring their own creativity to the realization of this cultural good. But the amazing thing is this pattern happens for every cultural good. So right now, the iPhone. How many people on a day-to-day basis are working on the iPhone? Well, I don't know, because I asked Steve Jobs and he wouldn't tell me. But I bet it's not much more than 120 people who are spending their days really investing their creativity in this new cultural good that they're about to launch. Ford Motor Company, one of the most complex corporations, this amazing thing called a multinational corporation that we have in our time, employs hundreds of thousands of people. But I actually wrote down the numbers here. How many people are the senior executives of Ford Motor Company? There's a CEO, a CFO, and three executive vice presidents. Five people, an absolutely small number of people, are at the heart of this huge enterprise. And they have 300 senior level officers, they say. But still, compared to 100,000 people selling millions of cars, or hundreds of thousands of cars every year, that's a very small number. And as I've started to look for this pattern, I've realized it happens all the time. So this conference is a cultural good, right? Someone created the idea to do this year, this specific one. And I got to meet with them because they asked me to speak. And I was in the office with Julie Sept, Patty Nicholson, and me. And that was it. And then Mark Laberton kind of wandered in, right? So the truth is, for this conference, Mark was not really part of the three, as far as I understand it, right? It really was carried by roughly three people. Then there was a group of about 12. In fact, I have their cell phone numbers. I didn't bring it with me. I have a little card that has the cell phone number of every staff who matters at this conference so that I can reach them all, because I'm very important and I need to know this information. So I'm going to call them all at 2 a.m. just to see if they're on their toes. Well, there's about 12 of them, right? And then, well, now, this is, on the whole, not a very complicated cultural good. So they didn't necessarily need 120 people, but there's probably another several dozen who have volunteered to make various parts of this happen. Every cultural good happens this way. Now, let me just give one more example that I thought was really interesting. There's this producer called Kanye West. Okay, he's probably one of the most prolific producers in popular music right now. In this age of social networking, we have this thing called friends. Are you familiar with the term friends? There's on MySpace, you can add people, right, as your friend. Well, Kanye West, last year, last time I checked, had 24,956 friends. Right? So you'd think, well, now here's someone who has real cultural power. I mean, he's got 25,000 people who are, like, wanting to be his friend. But when Kanye West sets out to produce a record, he does it this same way. In the studio, there's him, maybe another producer, the lead musician. They mobilize maybe a dozen people, maybe 120 A&R people and marketing people and distribution people get involved, and then we get a record out of it. And while Kanye West has 25,000 friends on Facebook, when you look at his 10-year discography, do you know how many records he's produced, how many things he's had a hand in producing? 59. So that's over 10 years. So that's about six a year. So that means six times over the course of his typical year, Kanye has found a handful of people, and they've created something together. Now, that raises the question, well, yeah, so Kanye West does this, and millions of people buy his records, and I make a little recording, and no one does anything with it, right? So we can feel, even this can feel sort of like deflating. It's a letdown, because I'm not in the right circle. Do you start to feel that way? Do you feel that way in your own cultural domain? Like, there's someone else who gets to be at the circle of three to make the really big thing, and I'm stuck over here in some little circle of three that nothing really ever happens. Maybe you don't feel that way. I feel that way all the time. Well, and that's actually the way we all feel about culture, because culture is so big and complicated that none of us get to be part of the circle of three for very many things. For instance, I have never been part of the circle of three for a Hollywood movie, and I don't think I ever will be. I'm not likely to be a person who's at that heart, that group of people who say, yes, we're going to make this movie, let's make it happen. But I'm part of circles of three that they can't be part of. See, what tends to happen when we start to talk about cultures, we think about mass culture. We think about the things that a small group makes but then get mass distribution and that all of us hear about, like Pirates of the Caribbean or the iPod. But the truth is that the people making those things only get to be part of a few circles themselves. And there are circles of cultural creativity we're part of that they have no access to. So I sometimes think about this in terms of the President of the United States of America, supposedly the most powerful person in the world. Now, the truth is the President's life follows the same pattern. How many people see the President every day? I'm sure it's not more than 12. How many people does he trust who he sees every day? Not much more than three. Well, this President, maybe there's none left. I don't know. How many people in the course of a week can reasonably expect to get access to the Oval Office? Not more than 120. That's actually almost exactly the number of so-called White House fellows or whatever they call them, the people who have that title, deputy director or something. The president can only work with his circle of a few people. Now, suppose the president wants to influence, let's say he cares about education. Well, there are things that he can do with his circle to make a big difference for education in America, there's no doubt. And he's tried to do some things, and we can agree or disagree about how he's done. But what the president can't do is what my neighbor, Beth Murray, can do. Because my neighbor, Beth Murray, is this amazingly connected person in the Swarthmore-Wallingford School District. And Beth is at the center of a circle of three that's part of this thing called the Swarthmore-Rutledge School Home and School Association. It's like our parent-teacher association. And they create culture. They shape the culture of my children's education in powerful ways, profound ways. And could George Bush ever do that? Suppose he decided, he, in his role as president now, that he wanted to sort of change the culture of the Swarthmore-Rutledge School. Well, what could he do? I mean, he could come and have a big event. You know how they bring in the cameras? You know, they put the little banner behind the president that says, education, 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 education. So you know that that's the theme of the day, right? And he could give a speech. It could disrupt the experience of the school for 24 or 48 hours. But then he has to leave. He actually has no power to create culture at the scale of our elementary school. But that matters a lot. The culture of that school matters a lot for the couple hundred students who are in that school. And Beth Murray is the person to go to if you want to create culture there. Okay, so we get all absorbed in what Steven Spielberg can make or what Jerry Bruckheimer can make. But there are things I can make that they cannot make and that they would really want to be made because they share in general more or less a vision for a good flourishing culture. There are things each of us can do because we're in different places. We're at different in different spheres and at different scales. And for a culture to be healthy, people need to be creating culture in all those places. This is the most liberating idea for me. Because, see, if I think that the only culture that matters is mass culture, well, I happen not to have much influence over mass culture. So I could scrape and be and strive and try to weasel my wedge my way into to those rooms where those decisions are made. And frankly, if I got there, I probably would have lost my my own personhood and integrity along the way because I'm just not made to be there. Or I can say, you know, it's between Steven Spielberg and God what he does in his circle of three. But God's given me a few people, and we might be able to make something together. And here's the other interesting thing. The people who make this sort of mass culture are amazingly dependent on local culture to give them new things to make. Pop culture is parasitic on local culture. And American Idol is like the best example of this. I mean, you know, American Idol takes all these people who just start small. They're just in some little town, and they develop some capacity, some more than others, and bring that in front of an audience. And lo and behold, mass culture comes out of it. But it starts with just somebody in a little town singing with a few friends. Mass culture is dependent. Political leaders are dependent on people like Beth Murray to do creative new things that they can then turn into big programs. They don't come up with those ideas in, you know, in the halls of power. They look for ideas that start local. So all the best culture started small. So the final calling question, my time is out, so you're going to have to talk about this in, with one another offline or later on. But is who is your three? I really believe God has given you a couple people or will give you a couple people to make something with. Now, it will not necessarily be huge, but it will be something that no one else can make, that some piece of local culture needs, that your block needs, that your homeroom needs, that your third grade students at your school need. And some of the things that people in this room make that start small will get bigger. They won't necessarily get huge, but they'll get bigger. Because there is a kind of principle in culture making when God gets behind it anyway, and we'll talk about this tomorrow, that those who are faithful with a little bit sometimes get asked to be faithful with a little more. So our job is not to worry about what other people are doing with their group of 3, 12, and 120. It's to ask, who has God given me? Who are my co-creators? Who are the 12 who would just love to gather around us and do something with us? And who are the kind of wider community